From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The Gulf oil spill, the environment, the economy, and the politics. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. From the Gulf Coast to the White House to the offices of the British oil giant BP, the word is unprecedented. Nobody's ever seen anything like this before. As an already massive slick moves toward the shoreline, it continues to grow, and it may take weeks to shut off the gushers 5,000 feet below. Just a month ago, President Obama lifted the moratorium on new offshore drilling, saying a competitive economy still needs energy from fossil fuels. Would worst-case scenarios be bad enough to change the equation? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Greece gets a bailout. Will it save the euro? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. BP says it's responsible for whatever cleanup the Gulf oil spill requires. As the slick moves closer to shore, we'll hear what could be in store for wildlife, economic interest, and America's continuing appetite for energy. On Reporter's Notebook, Greek unions respond to an international bailout by calling a general strike. First, this news update. Delegates from France, Britain, and the United States walked out of today's UN conference on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They were protesting a speech by Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. After attacking the U.S., he made a veiled reference to Western support for Israel's nuclear weapons.
Wars, acts of aggression, and above all, the shadow of threat resulting from the stockpiling of nuclear armaments, and even worse, unfair policies applied by a select group of expansionist states, have obscured the prospect of international security.
Obviously, a translator speaking for the president of Iran. In Washington, the Obama White House said Ahmadinejad failed to address Iran's obligations and accused him of wild accusations. Colm Lynch is U.N. correspondent for The Washington Post. Always good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
In addition to the Israeli stockpiling, the president of Iran also mentioned America's use of nuclear weapons during World War II and this embarrassing incident that occurred recently when nuclear weapons were mistakenly flown across the United States. How did the audience react to all of that?
Well, I mean, you know, it seemed preordained that the Americans and its European allies would walk out of the meeting. So they did that, you know, once he sort of well into his speech to show, to protest his harsh speech against the United States and Israel, but I think they probably would have done it one way or another. Generally, you know, the people you expect to walk out of the place walked out, and the rest, you know, of the audience, when he finished his speech, there was polite applause at the end of it, as there always is. I mean, I think the thing that really struck me as kind of different in this event was the degree to which the Secretary General of the UN and the new Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, how they seem to sort of gang up on Ahmadinejad. They had very, very strong language indicating, blaming him for, you know, provoking the nuclear crisis that Iran is engaged with the United States and the rest of the Security Council, strong demands, you know, on Iran to comply with its obligation to stop its uranium enrichment activities. I don't think I've ever seen a Secretary General, you know, sort of, you know, taking someone to the mat, a world, you know, a head of state like that, right to their face in the General Assembly Hall. So that was quite extraordinary and reflected a certain degree of anxiety about his presence and that it might jeopardize, you know, the broader goals that they're seeking at this, you know, nuclear conference.
The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is expected to address the UN later today. Is there any chance she will address some of the issues that Ahmadinejad raised, for example, the Israeli stockpiling of nuclear weapons?
I doubt she'll talk much about, you know, the Israeli, you know, nuclear program, which everybody knows that they have a nuclear weapons program, but they don't sort of formally address it. I suspect that on the issue of Israel, the thing that she will talk to, which will be important, will be the whole issue of the establishment of a nuclear weapons-free zone. This has been a very controversial issue. There was a commitment by the membership back in 1995 to take steps to make progress towards establishing a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, and that's sort of aimed at Israel. Now Iran is thrown into the mix as well. So there has been, the Bush administration was not willing to make any kind of movement on this and was not sort of abiding by that 95 commitment. So I think you'll see the U.S. kind of saying that they want some agreement that will put some pressure on Israel to take steps in that direction, but they're not going to accept anything that would require, binding a commitment on Israel to disarm or to take steps towards disarmament.
Back to Ahmadinejad, what are its obligations under the nuclear proliferation, non-proliferation treaty? Iran, of course, says that all it's doing is building the capacity to have nuclear power.
Right. Well, I mean, under the NPT, states that agree to forego nuclear weapons are also subject to monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Agency. The interesting thing is that the International Atomic Energy Agency recognized that their sort of safeguards, sort of procedures, were ineffective in sort of stopping countries like Iraq in the 1990s and North Korea from stopping their programs. They realized that there were flaws and gaps in the inspection regime. So there's been an effort since the late 1990s to create additional requirements that they call the additional protocol that strengthen the IAEA's ability to inspect. So they can go to sites that aren't declared. They can do other things. So the Iranians, the IAEA sort of takes the position that we cannot, certify that you are not pursuing nuclear weapons. We have suspicions that you might be, and you need to cooperate further. And one of the things that you need to do is agree to these this additional protocol to allow more intrusive investigations. And they have allowed them sort of temporarily, but they are no longer abiding by that.
All right. This conference going on now at the UN is expected to continue for some time, the Conference on the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. We will see what happens next. Colm Lynch, always good to talk with you.
All right. Thanks for having me, Warren.
United Nations correspondent for The Washington Post, also blogs at turtlebay.com, writes the Turtle Bay column at foreignpolicy.com. In a moment, the Gulf oil spill, the environment, the economy, and the politics on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. For almost 2 weeks, the Gulf Coast has been in a state of high anxiety as the oil slick gets closer and closer to shore and grows larger and larger. Listen closely to the language used by President Obama.
We're dealing with a massive and potentially unprecedented environmental disaster. The oil that is still leaking from the well could seriously damage the economy and the environment of our Gulf states, and it could extend for a long time.
Some of the key words: massive, unprecedented, economy, environment, and for a long time. Mark Schlefstein reports for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And Mark, we got familiar with you during the Katrina crisis. Didn't expect to have you back talking about something of this magnitude soon.
I didn't expect to be talking about it either, that's for sure.
What's the latest from the shoreline of Louisiana?
Well, I guess the most important thing is that it looks like BP has speeded up the process of trying to get at least the first attempt to corral this oil underway. They built this big metal concrete box and hope to get it out to the rig site by this weekend and put it in place over at least two of the leaks. This thing would basically capture the oil at the bottom, and then it would be piped up to the surface where it would be collected in a tanker or something and, taken off. If that works, they have another one that's under construction for the third leak that's a bit farther away from this first one. At the same time, they also have been reporting some progress, some success with using dispersant materials deep under the water right at the site of the leak to cause that material to turn into tiny little pieces of oil rather than one big thick blob. And so that also seems to be successful. They're still trying to figure out what sort of environmental effects that might have on the bottom of the ocean right where it's occurring.
You're talking about a four-story high, 70-ton structure. How are they going to get it down there? How do they guide it? Will they use the remote-controlled submarines to get it to cover the leaks?
That is what I understand is going to happen, is that they'll use these ROVs, is what they call them, to guide them in place. But largely, it's on a it'll be taken out there by a huge ship and put in, and just moved over top of it and dropped down into the water and carefully guided in place.
So, meantime, what about the surface? And have you seen oil yet on the shores of Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida?
Well, this is the frustration that we like to see, which is that nobody is, we're still not seeing any oil reported other than tiny little clumps that may have washed ashore on some of the barrier islands off of Louisiana, and haven't gotten any reports elsewhere. But, it's a matter of time. It's unclear how much of this stuff will make it to shore because it's still pretty unclear exactly what the makeup of this material is. It's supposed to be light crude, which could mean that it has enough volatile organic materials in it that those volatiles will, basically disappear by the time it gets to shore. But there will be some of the heavier elements that will remain as it moves into the shoreline.
So it could evaporate, or large parts of it could evaporate. What about going out into the Atlantic? I've heard reports that that might happen.
Really unclear. One of the things about this is that it's a huge, I guess you'd call it a bolus of oil that's out there now, and nobody really knows how long it'll stay in place or how long it'll take to get there. I would expect, based on past experience, the 1993 flood of the Mississippi River, a huge chunk of that water ended up going east instead of west, as it normally might do, hugging the coast of Louisiana, but instead went east, went down the western coast of Florida, and went over the Florida Keys before getting caught up in the Gulf Stream and going right up the east coast of Florida. That's a possibility, but it's all this stuff is way too soon to tell.
But your paper and others are publishing stories about people in the fishing business, the recreation business, who are predicting that they might simply be out of business, perhaps for years to come.
Well, again, it depends on how much oil comes in and how difficult it is to clean it up. And a lot of unknowns here. There's no question that the fishermen have definitely already seen their seasons this year. It looks like they're pretty much going to be canceled. And what happens to the oyster beds in that area is a real problem. You have to remember that, Louisiana over the last 15, 20 years has become the key supplier of oysters to the United States because of the failure of oysters largely in Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real problem for the supply of fish.
Okay, and something like 40% of all the fishing industry in the United States is headquartered in the Gulf, as I understand it. Mark Schlestein, it's really good to have you back on our program. I'm sorry for the occasion. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
Staff writer for the Times-Picayune. Rayola Duer is Senior Economic Advisor for the American Petroleum Institute, that's a trade association for oil and natural gas companies, and it's good to have you on our program.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
Given the fact that this dome of, or box, however you describe it, is now about to be placed and that the oil hasn't yet arrived on shore, is there any possibility at all that we've been exaggerating the magnitude of this disaster?
It doesn't seem like that to me. I mean, if it's 5,000 barrels a day, it's a lot of oil. It's something that we're, of course, very concerned about and extremely engaged in the process of trying to, mitigate the impacts to shore and trying to shut this leak down. So my understanding is BP is doing just about every single thing that can possibly be done. If it was 1,000 barrels a day or 5,000 or whatever it is, their response has been thorough, and the government's response and that cooperation between the two. There's about 2,000 staff personnel involved, 300 response vessels. They've got, I understand, over 200,000 feet of booms, 300,000 more feet coming. They have staging areas. I can't imagine they've left anything undone. And they have teams of engineers working round the clock trying to solve the issues with the blowout preventer, building this dome, and also looking at starting the drilling of a parallel well to, if all else fails, they're doing this anyway, to make sure that they can at least take the pressure off the one well by drilling a parallel well. But that takes time. That can take weeks and weeks. So this dome is the next best thing, and they're still trying the blowout preventers, the dispersants, and whatever else can be done to stop the leak and also mitigate the impact of the shoreline and step up in terms of providing telephone numbers, providing whatever we can to make sure that every response is being made that can be made.
BP has said that it is responsible for whatever the cleanup cost. It said it is not responsible, however, for the leak itself. Who might be if it's not BP? And are we going to see pitched battles in court and elsewhere between different companies in your industry?
Well, we do have a spill response fund of $1.9 billion to draw from. Yeah, the government has that fund, and it's funded through taxes on oil companies. So that fund is available, and BP has also said that they will honor any claims being made by fishermen or whoever has a claim.
Yeah, but what about the cause of the disaster itself?
Well, I think that's what we're going to have to find out. We need to know exactly what happened. Was it a piece of equipment? Obviously, the blowout preventer didn't work. And so that's one thing we already know. We don't know why it didn't work, but it did not work. And was it a combination of events? And until we know exactly what happened, what failed, I don't think we can answer that. But we do know. We're going to find out.
Okay. Rayola Dora, again, excuse me. I'll come back to you in a moment. I want to introduce another guest and move on. Again, Rayola Dora is a senior economic advisor for the API, the American Petroleum Institute. Tyson Slocum is director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He has reported on BP's safety record in particular. Tyson Slocum, good to have you on our program.
Yeah, great to be here.
Now, what about this exchange of, BP's statement that it's responsible for the cleanup but not for the accident itself? And what about its safety record?
Well, I mean, that sounds like it's kind of talking out of two sides of its mouth, because the fact is that they own the lease, and their management should have been overseeing any contractors it was hiring, whether that contractor was Transocean, who BP was renting the oil rig from at a rate of $500,000 a day, or Halliburton, which was cementing the well in preparation for a more active drilling operation. The fact is that BP managers would have been overseeing all facets of this operation. That said, BP has a very, very troubling safety record. In fact, Public Citizens show that BP has the worst track record of any oil company operating in America over the last several years. They have pled guilty to two felonies related to violations of environmental laws, and they've paid nearly $600 million in fines, penalties, and settlements related to violations of environmental laws, workplace safety laws, and market manipulation laws. So when you look at the track record of the company, it is very upsetting to see a foreign-based company that has such a poor track record of adhering to U.S. Statutes.
Let me ask you this. The Minerals Management Service in the Department of Homeland Security or Interior, I'm not sure which department it's in or which agency it's in, has scheduled for today a safety awards ceremony, and it's now been canceled. But BP was a finalist for one of the awards. How do you explain that?
Well, that shows the reason why they're canceling the awards ceremony, because it's a little embarrassing. The fact is that, you know, BP has extensive operations, and so you have to recognize that accidents and problems are going to occur. But the severity of the issues at play here And the fact that they have been found guilty on two separate occasions of felonies is very significant. Remember,
let me go back. Let me go back to Rayola Adur at the American Petroleum Institute for that. Are these things common within the industry?
Absolutely not. You know, and safety is the industry's absolute first priority. And if you look out there, you can just look out at the fact that we have 3,500 platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, all of them operating smoothly. No one appreciates better than the men and women that work in this industry how difficult and how dangerous this job is.
What about this record of BP we're hearing?
Well, you know, I think it's unfair right now to point a finger at BP. We don't know what happened. We really don't know. We don't know if it was a failure, an operating failure. We don't know if it was a technology failure, a cementing failure. We really don't know what happened. We do know that this has shocked the industry that didn't think this could happen because we have so many redundant systems in place. If one thing fails, there's a backup. There's a backup. We have as many as three people looking at the same screen, monitoring pressures as they're drilling a well. It's like having three air traffic controllers looking at the same screen. No one knows what happened yet, and I think it's really premature and irresponsible to point a finger right now at any one company.
Let me introduce Robert Bryce. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative organization, managing editor of the Energy Tribune, author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Robert Bryce, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
You're a supporter of offshore oil drilling, as I understand it, but how do you see what's happening right now?
Well, look, Warren, this spill is horrific. It's awful. And I say that as somebody who has spent hours fishing and bird watching and swimming in the Gulf. And I think that it's clear that, I mean, even if they cap the well now and are able to stop the leak, the environmental and political consequences of this accident are going to reverberate in American politics and American energy policy for years, probably decades to come.
What about what we just heard about the record of BP? Does BP deserve most of the blame here, or is it, as Ray Adur suggests, too early to be handing out blame?
Well, look, I wrote a piece on BP's safety record back in September of 2005. We just reposted it on Energy Tribune today. It's unfortunate, but BP's safety record is beyond pathetic. I mean, they said they were going to be beyond petroleum, but the fact is it's beyond pathetic. And you know, it may be the blowout preventer, it may be the bad cement job, but it's BP's operation. And for them to have the Texas City refinery explosion and then the Thunder Horse near mishap of nearly sinking the entire platform. I mean, if it was one or two or three events, it would be one thing. But unfortunately, I mean, the only thing I can say, and I take no pleasure in it, is that there's some cultural problems, it appears, at BP, and they're serious
okay.
ones.
Okay. We've got to take a break. We'll come back, continue this conversation. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, will the bailout of Greece be enough to save the euro? Check us out on To The Point, too. You can become a fan on our Facebook page. Back in a moment with To The Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the oil spill in the Gulf, what caused it, what's being done to stop the continuing flow at a time when the slick itself has not yet reached shore. But, of course, there are dire predictions from everybody, including the oil industry, about what will happen when it does. Wesley Warren is Director of Programs for the NRDC. That's the Natural Resources Defense Council. Joins us from Washington. Wesley Warren, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me today.
About a month ago, the president said he was going to lift the moratorium on new offshore oil drilling. And your organizations, despite its name and its concerns about the environment, was somewhat supportive of what he was doing. Other environmental organizations were extremely opposed. What's your position now?
Well, even at that time, we said to the president, there's a better way
of supplying our energy needs and protecting our environment, and that you didn't have to trade one of these off for the other. And that's our view today, that the first thing we should do is get a giant wake-up call out of this and stop expansion of oil development into new areas until we can establish the science behind this particular spill.
Okay, until. But you're not saying stop oil drilling altogether.
No, our view is that we have oil development already underway. We should make sure we have state-of-the-art technologies to prevent this type of accident in the future. But the fact of the matter is you can get much more oil more safely and more cost-effectively onshore on places where you already have oil fields, and by squeezing the oil out of all the oil that we're currently using in automobiles through greater fuel efficiency.
Where is the oil onshore, and does that include the shale oil that is so controversial?
It could include shale oil, but more importantly, it's what's called enhanced oil recovery. That's when you take existing oil fields that you've extracted so much oil out of it that the pressure has dropped and it's not economical to continue extracting it, and you take CO2, inject it underground, increase the pressure, and extend the life of those fields. The big constraint on doing that CO2 injection is the amount of CO2 that's available, and so this is a great opportunity to combine addressing concerns about climate change by capturing carbon and injecting it underground and enhancing our oil production domestically onshore.
Wesley Warren with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Rayola Dewar, back to you with the American Petroleum Institute. What about that? Would it be possible to get a comparable amount of oil from the sources that are being suggested by Wesley Warren as you might get from expanding offshore drilling?
Well, about 75% of our oil resources and 65% of our natural gas resources are estimated to be offshore. We do use enhanced oil recovery techniques, so that is being employed today, but that's really no substitute for the resources that we do have offshore. We have been developing them safely. We've had the technology, and our industry was very proud of its operations, especially during Hurricanes Rita and Katrina offshore. It was evidence to us that our technology worked and our systems worked, and this accident is a big shock, so we're going to figure out what happened, we're going to fix it, and we're going to go back and try to continue to fuel the United States.
Rayola Dewar, again, a senior economic advisor for the American Petroleum Institute. Thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thank you.
Robert Bryce, let me go back to you with the Manhattan Institute. What do you say to Wesley Warren's suggestion that there is a better way, and that's where we ought to go?
Well, look, the industry has been doing enhanced oil recovery for decades. This is nothing new. The reality is, as bad as this spill is, it doesn't change the laws of physics. If oil didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. Nothing else comes close to oil in terms of energy density, flexibility, or ease of use. So what I see happening is, yes, the U.S. is likely to decrease the amount of leasing activity offshore, but the fact is offshore exploration is going to continue in Brazil, Nigeria, Angola, West Africa, all over the world because three reasons. That's where the available oil is. Oil demand continues growing. Since the Exxon Valdez, global consumption has increased by 30%. And finally, hundreds of billions of dollars have been invested in offshore oil and gas, in the offshore oil and gas business. So this is a terrible accident, there's no question. But it's the offshore oil and gas business is not going to slow down, I think, even a little bit overall, because the demand is simply too great.
Wesley Warren with the Natural Resources Defense Council, what do you say to that?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind, what are we talking about here? We're talking at best pennies at the pump if we develop these offshore reserves that we haven't explored and developed yet. But we're putting at risk a huge industry, recreational and fishery industry in America, worth over $100 billion a year. Louisiana fishing industry, the second in the country, is about to get slammed. It's too risky to do this offshore when we have better alternatives, not only onshore, but eventually through efficiency and renewable energy technology, ridding ourselves of this dependence on oil.
You said this was a wake-up call. What about all these other countries around the world? They're not going to stop doing this, are they?
Well, we really it's time for the administration to realize that this is a historic opportunity, like after the Santa Barbara blowout, after Exxon Valdez. it really gave a generation a chance to say, what are we going to do to change the path of energy and environmental policy? And that needs to be a global revolution. And so getting off of our dependence on oil by electrifying the grid with renewable energy technologies and have a transportation system that we can plug into it is really the direction that the president needs to take, not only the world, not only the U.S., but the entire world.
Wesley Warren with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Earlier, Robert Bryce mentioned the political implications of all of this. Michael Levy is a senior fellow, or Levy, excuse me, is a senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's blogged today about the last 20 years of oil spills. Nothing new about oil spills, Michael Levy. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
What do you think are the political consequences? Here we have Wesley Warren saying that the administration had better wake up. This is an opportunity for a global change. How does it break down here in this country, particularly in this election year?
Well, it's going to be difficult for the administration, to say the least, to push ahead with its plans for expanding offshore oil drilling. The place where it all comes together most clearly is going to be in the upcoming fight over an energy and climate bill, where, again, the consequences may be a bit perverse. The idea behind that bill, or at least one of the ideas behind that bill, was to trade expanded efforts to move toward a clean energy economy with expansion of opportunity for offshore drilling. If offshore drilling is off the table, it's not clear that there is a deal that can be made.
So back to Wesley Warren of the NRDC on that. Is it back to the drawing board for that bill?
Well, it certainly is an opportunity now for the Congress to see what's at stake, to hear from the American people that they really do want change, and to finally get the job done on a true energy bill that would move us forward in the way that we need to go, one that will create jobs, will enhance our national security by reducing this dependence on oil, but will also curtail pollution.
Michael Levy, what about the partisan consequences? There are a lot of Republicans in office in Mississippi, in Louisiana, and in Florida as well. Does this work politically differently for one party than it does for the other?
I'm not sure that this is going to be hugely helpful for either political party. There's clearly been an attempt to paint the Obama administration as being asleep at the switch on this. I don't think that that's sticking. We have to wait and see what some of the Republican governors in the various states affected say. I think that will set the tone for the partisan controversy over this. You also heard over the weekend from Sarah Palin, who I must admit from my perspective doesn't normally say particularly wise things about energy, but she I think captured it quite well in looking back at the Exxon Valdez incident. She said, look, the affected areas were all in Alaska, but Alaska still pushed ahead with oil exploration. It's not clear to me that other parts of the country will behave all that differently. Where it does get a bit more complicated here is that, unlike with Alaska, you have a variety of different states affected. So you may have exploration in one and production in one state and environmental consequences in another, and that makes the politics a lot more complicated.
There could be environmental consequences, though, in all of the states affected, could there not?
Well, certainly there will be environmental consequences in all of the states affected. As we go forward in looking at where exploration and production happens, you can have situations where one state takes the revenues, but other states see the consequences. And that's the real story here. I mean, you heard numbers about the impact on fishing and whatnot. The revenues from oil and gas are still much higher, but the revenues go to one set of players, and the consequences end up hitting another. That's really the crux of what's happening here.
Let me go back to Robert Bryce at the Manhattan Institute and the Energy Tribune. How do you see this shaping down politically? You said there were going to be long-term consequences. How do you feel about what we just heard from Michael Levy?
Well, I think Michael makes some good points. I think one of the intriguing things that it seems to me is fairly obvious here is that the Obama administration is not going to offer any more offshore leases to the industry. There's no way. The chances of that happening are slim and none, as my dad said, slim left town. What I think it's going to mean over the long term is going to be more oil imports. If we slow down offshore drilling in the U.S., and I'm in favor of drilling onshore and offshore, but if we slow offshore drilling in the U.S., It's going to mean we're going to be more reliant on imported oil. And we can do all we can on electric cars and everything else, but we've been working on those for decades. Oil still drives the U.S. economy. It still drives the world economy. And as unfortunate as all this is, I think the reality is the U.S. is going to be even more dependent and interdependent, because we also export a lot of oil. We're going to be relying on international sources for crude and for refined products probably more than we are now.
Going to see an increase in the price of gasoline?
You know, I don't think it's necessarily going to translate to the price at the pump right away, although I think it will mean inferior gasoline at the pump, because if you notice last week, Obama went to the ethanol plant in Missouri, which I think is a clear signal that the Obama administration is going to go ahead with this move toward E15, which is really just a bailout of the ethanol industry.
We have a lot of Republican governors, Robert Bryce, in these southern states. Jindal in Louisiana, Crist in Florida. Former Republican chair is Haley Barbour, is the governor of Mississippi. How do you think all of them are going to react to this?
Well, and Governor Perry here in Texas.
That too, excuse me, of course.
Well, you know, I think it all depends, Warren. I can't predict that one, but I think that. I mean, a lot of these guys, yes, they're Republicans, but they're pragmatists, and I think they understand that for all the problems, as I've been saying with the spill, and it's horrific, oil drives our transportation systems. And, you know, we can try and electrify cars, but we're not going to electrify 747s or ocean-going vehicles. I mean, you know, the problem is that oil, when it comes down to it, it's energy density, it's convenience, ease of use. There's nothing else that can compare.
Wesley Warren, back to you with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Let's look at this from a global perspective. What's your take? How do you critique what we've just heard? And do you think that that the kind of alternatives that you are advocating are going to be available anytime soon to deal with what we're seeing now as an immediate crisis?
Well, I think one thing that we need to get clear is that as long as you are dependent upon oil in America, you will be dependent upon foreign oil, because they will always be able to produce more of it cheaper than we can do at home. And also, the amount of oil reserves that are in these offshore areas, especially areas we've never drilled before in highly sensitive environments, is so small that even the Department of Energy said it would have an insignificant impact on our oil imports. So the question is, what makes sense right now for us to be doing about our energy needs that also leads us to a long-term solution? And the first thing that we need to do is to greatly increase the efficiency that we use and consume all the oil that we're doing now. And there's plenty of opportunities in the transportation sector already to extend our miles per gallon. And then the next thing that you need to do is to increase the efficiency of the production onshore. So efficiency is the cheapest, cleanest, quickest way to get there anyway. And those are compatible with a long-term path of eventually being able to us to have plug-in hybrids that get 100 miles a gallon or more and eventually aren't dependent upon oil whatsoever.
Michael Levy, back to you. Again, you've studied the impact of the past 20 years of oil spills. Do you think that it's likely that this one, which does appear to be unprecedented, to use the president's word, is going to have a major effect in the Congress? Will the kinds of arguments we're hearing from Wesley Warren now be front and center in a Congress that has been relatively conservative in this area?
I don't see this swinging the balance in Congress on the issue strongly. I think Robert Bryce is correct when he says that there are people with certain positions, and those positions are pretty well dug in. So I don't see a strong swing and bounce. I think there'll be a few tilts in opinion. Frankly, there may be more entrenchment amongst those who resist offshore drilling as part of a bargain. But we're going to need to, over the long term, move to an economy that uses less oil, both domestic and foreign. That does mean much more investment in technology. I know we heard Robert Bryce say that we haven't got that far with things like electric vehicles. We also haven't invested all that much effort in the grand scheme of things compared to the scale of the oil industry in trying to get there. So there's a lot that I think Congress will want to do. I should add to that that in areas like support for alternative fuels, like support for electrification, you may see a bit of an uptick in interest from Congress. Some places that are less controversial than things like greenhouse gas emission restrictions, which are at the heart of this energy and climate bill.
To be specific about one person we've talked about a lot on this program and who's been in the news, what about Governor Crist of Florida? Now he has become an independent. He's apparently changed positions on offshore drilling. Any take on how that might affect his run for the U.S. Senate?
Well, he has some space to wait and see how this is playing out in Florida and then really solidify his position. What he's come out and said, essentially, is that you have to look at this and clearly step back and think about your position. That gives him some time, some space to then come out with a position that reflects a pragmatism, both on the substance, but also, frankly, on the politics, and that's what he's going to be looking for.
Robert Bryce, a different kind of question for you than these long-term policy questions and political questions, or global questions for that matter. What about the very specific issues that you confront as a person who lives near and enjoys being in some of the areas that might be destroyed? Robert Bryce? We seem to have lost Robert Bryce. He is a fisherman. He is a person who enjoys, again, the recreational aspects of that area, as well, as the fishing and the food that comes out of the ocean and out of the area around there. Wesley Warren, let me put the same kind of question to you. I know you don't live down there, but what about the wildlife? What about the not just the standard of living of the human beings there, but the nature of the place itself?
Well, those two are really connected. There's a huge community of people who really depend upon these natural resources for a living and for a way of life, and now that's been fundamentally threatened. We could see from the Exxon Valdez spill how long it took for those areas to recover, and some of them, in fact, never truly did. The recreational and fishing industry that I referred to earlier in this discussion is a 2 million job industry in America. And so often when you have environmental degradation, what you have is proof that some industry is profiting at the expense of another industry and way of life in this case. So really preserving these wetlands and the fisheries and the other associated ecological values is really essential, I think, to also saving these communities.
Robert Bryce, back to you. You're still with us. What about your personal experience?
Well, my personal experience, I mean, I've been fishing. I've vacationed at the beach in the Gulf of Mexico. I just spoke to a friend of mine this morning who's an avid fisherman. I mean, everybody who goes to the Gulf is heartbroken on this. This is it's a disaster of the first order, and hopefully it can be contained. I mean, I'll shift the discussion a little bit if I can, and that is, so what does this mean though long term? I think it in terms of policy for the U.S. to take some of the things that Mr. Levy's been discussing. I think it's probably a positive for the U.S. domestic natural gas business because they can say, look, we're not offshore, where our environmental risks are contained, and it probably gives some more traction to the natural gas sector, and particularly people like Boone Pickens who are saying, let's use more natural gas in transportation.
I thought our earlier guest from the API, the American Petroleum Institute, said that a lot of the natural gas was offshore.
Well, look, I mean, yes, there is a lot of natural gas offshore, but what we're getting from the Gulf of Mexico is maybe 10 or about 15% of our domestic gas. The big revolution in the U.S. industry has been the shale gas revolution. The last 3 or 4 years, the industry has figured out how to tap galaxies of natural gas from shale, and we now have approximately 100-year supply of natural gas because of these kind of breakthroughs in new onshore drilling. So it's fundamentally changed the picture for natural gas, and I think it probably the political problems for offshore oil are probably going to accrue to the benefit of natural gas and, unfortunately, in my opinion, to the corn ethanol business.
We're out of time, but Wesley Warren, there are problems with the shale development of an environmental nature as well, aren't there?
Well, that's also a technology that you have to do in the right way, and that not area all areas are suitable for it. But I would say that this particular disaster is huge, and we need a response which is huge to meet it for our nation.
We're out of time. Wesley Warren with the Natural Resources Defense Council, Robert Bryce with the Energy Tribune, author of Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence, Michael Levy at the Environmental Council on Foreign, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks to you all. Thanks to our other guests as well. In a moment, the heads of 16 European governments are scheduled to meet on Friday to hasten release of 110 billion in euros to bail out Greece and stabilize the currency. Meantime, the Greeks are looking at increased taxes and cuts in services. More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Roman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In Germany, there has been significant opposition to the bailout of Greece. In Greece itself, tough measures led to calls for a general strike on Wednesday. Nick Malkoutsis is deputy editor of the English edition of Katimerini, a national newspaper. Nick Malkoutsis, it's good to have you on our program.
Pleasure to be with you.
Obviously, a very unhappy people, particularly the union leaders in Greece. What do you expect to have happen on Wednesday?
Well, we've got a general strike on Wednesday, 24-hour general strike, in which the both the public sector unions and the private sector unions will take part. The public sector unions will have also called an extraordinary strike for tomorrow, one that wasn't planned. So they're going off the job tomorrow, and I think this is just the start of the industrial action that we'll see over the next few weeks and perhaps months.
Do you think that the strikes will have any impact on these on the rest of Europe and on the on the markets and their response to the bailout?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be uncomfortable for the government here. I don't think it's going to have an impact beyond Greece. It's obviously it won't be the best advertisement for Greece and stability in Greece beyond our borders, because obviously images of people protesting or rioting, as inevitably happens, make bad publicity for Greece. But I think it will be more unpleasant for the government here, which is having a tough time convincing people about these measures. I don't think that it will impact on the international markets, because I think they've decided, they know that the Greek government has no option. It's going to enact these tough measures, and it's going to have to see them through. And the fact that officials from the International Monetary Fund will be here monitoring the progress, I think, puts markets at ease.
What exactly are the Greek people going to have to endure in the way of further taxes and cuts in services?
Well, the latest round of austerity measures announced yesterday puts forward a drastic cut in wages and salaries in the public sector. For a long time, it had been felt that public sector employees were it was a coveted position to work in the public sector. The salaries were usually good. The working conditions were fairly relaxed, but that's all gone out the window now. The salaries have been cut drastically by over 20%. Benefits have been cut. It's now going to be very difficult to get a job in the public sector, and in fact, we're going to see people leave that line of work over the next few years, and no one replace them. In the private sector, for the average Greek, the austerity measures mean simply that everyday goods become more expensive. Value-added tax, the top band, has gone up from 19 to 25% over the last couple of months. Supermarket goods, which are at a lower rate, have gone up to 11%. They were at 8% earlier in the year. And so everything that the average Greek does in a normal day will now be more expensive.
Now, a value-added tax comes at various different times along the way, so its effect multiplies on the price of goods. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And you know, there's a fear now that things, for instance, fuel, the tax on fuel as well has gone up, and there's a fear that everyday goods will now become just too expensive for some people, and the government is pleading with supermarkets, with other stores to look at their profit margins and try and bring those down in an effort to control the prices.
Will it be more expensive now for tourists in Greece or less expensive?
That's a good question, and I guess it's one we won't really be able to answer until the summer comes. I have a feeling that overall it may be less expensive because although the everyday goods will have gone up in price and eating out theoretically could be more expensive, I have a feeling that tavernas, restaurants will be looking at their prices because the local people won't be eating there as much, so they will have to attract custom. I also think that hotels will be looking to do better deals. So I imagine people thinking of about visiting Greece will get a better deal this year than they have in recent years.
But for the moment, you're looking at a lot of unhappy people, I take it. You said the general strike and possibly riots as well.
Yes, the protests march inevitably end in small-scale riots. I think that, you know, there is the majority of the population realize that Greece is in an extremely precarious situation and really didn't have a lot of other options, and that this government doesn't have a lot of other options. But there is a hardcore of support or opposition to these measures, led by the unions, led by some opposition parties who will not accept them no matter what.
Well, thank you very much for being on our program. Nick Malkoutsis, again, deputy editor, English edition of Kata Merani, also blogger at Inside Greece. Good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
Today's program produced by Francis Anderton, Gary Scott, and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/To The Point, and become a fan of To The Point on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.